All right, guys, thanks for coming back. This is episode 258, only two more episodes to 260. What's so special about 260? Well, nothing, but
welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
And it's pretty cool. In the news this week, not a whole lot going on in Masonry. Well, I guess there are a few things that are going on, some of which are a little wonky, and you'll probably hear about them on the Masonic Roundtable. But I did want to mention something pretty interesting. Illustrious David A. Glatley, 33rd degree, was named as the next Sovereign Grand Commander for the Scottish Rite Northern Masonic Jurisdiction. This is a little unprecedented. It's pretty neat. Usually, this doesn't happen until closer to the election time, but their press release says that the Scottish Rite Sovereign Grand Commander John William McNaughton has the pleasure to announce to the membership today that active member David A. Glatley, 33rd degree, will succeed him as the leader of the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction upon his retirement in August of 2017. He said, "To our valued members and brothers, I could not be more pleased to inform you that the Supreme Council's nominating committee has named David Glatley as your next Sovereign Grand Commander. Brother Glatley has been an active and honored Freemason for more than 40 years, and a member of the Scottish Rite for nearly three decades. Our fraternity will be led by a good man who serves from his heart. He will shoulder great responsibility with intelligence, experience, dedication, and grace." So the appointment of Brother Glatley marks the first time a new Scottish Rite leader has been announced a year prior to taking office, hence my use of the word unprecedented. He said, "These are challenging times for Freemasonry," said Commander McNaughton. "Your Scottish Rite leadership and I feel it is important to have a thorough and seamless transition for our fraternity. Commander McNaughton and Brother Glatley will consult together over the next 12 months to continue the work, quote, we began a decade ago, shifting the priorities of Northern Masonic Jurisdiction back to caring for our members and bringing compassion to the forefront of the fraternity," he said. So you can read the rest of that, is another paragraph or so, on the Scottish Rite NMJ.org. It's kind of interesting. The direction of the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction is pretty well different from the rest of the fraternity as a whole. Focuses mostly, it seems, as a benevolent society for its members. But regardless, really cool, exciting news coming out of the Northern Jurisdiction. So congratulations to illustrious Brother David L. Glatley, 33rd degree, for being named the next Sovereign Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite Northern Jurisdiction. Nice job, guys. So outside of that, not a whole lot going on. So we're just going to go right into the first piece this week, which is called The Sound of the Gavel. Now, I have largely tried to stay away from reading Short Talk bulletins as of late because the Short Talk bulletins are being recorded as podcasts already, if you guys didn't know. They just started this not too long ago, and it benefits the MSA. You get a subscription, and I think you purchase it or something. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but you can check it out. I think the brother who does them regularly publishes on the Winding Stairs group. So check it out. I'm sure it's pretty cool. They're exclusively dedicated to Short Talk bulletins, so it's pretty cool. But just the same, I'm going to read a Short Talk bulletin, Volume 3, October 1925, Number 10, by Unknown. And this one kind of hit me just from the first paragraph because we're getting really close, and you'll know what I'm talking about. "The long summer days are gone. Autumn is here, and the world takes up its tasks. The judge returns to his bench, the preacher to his pulpit, the man of affairs to his desk, and the teacher to his or her school, the boys and girls following with no quick step. To some it is a joy, to others a grind, but all return to the work appointed to them to do. Last but not least, the lodge is opened, tiled and tested, and the sound of the gavel in the east calls the craft from refreshment to labor. Soon the noisy quarries will be busy making ready the stone for the living temple, slowly rising without the sound of a hammer or axe, built by faith and labor of good and wise men as a shrine of fellowship and a shelter for the holy things in life. The common gavel, it is a symbol both of labor and of power. As the square is no doubt the oldest instrument of our science, so the gavel is its oldest working tool. Some trace it back to the rude axe of the Stone Age. How simple it is! Just a piece of metal with a beating surface at one end and a cutting edge at the other, with a handle for better effect in use. Every Mason knows by heart the explanation of its meaning, given him in the first degree. In this, the words are simple. Their meaning is plain. Searching, too, when we think of the rough and superfluous things which need to be broken off and polished away from the best of us before we are fit to be used by the master of all good work. Alas, the words are so familiar that we too often forget how pointed and practical they are, teaching us the first necessity of the craft, its need of clean and square men. As we listened to those words for the first time, we did not realize how much meaning they held. No one can. There are so many delicate touches in masonry, so many fine arts that time is needed to see and appreciate them. Its business is to build men, taking the raw stuff of us and shaping it into forms of beauty and use. Before us, it holds an ideal and plan of a temple, into which it seeks to build our lives as stones. So it begins by using the gavel, cutting away rough edges and breaking off ugly vices. Any man who knows himself at all knows how much it is needed, if he is to be a true man. Nor did we notice in the surprise of initiation that the gavel is also used by the master of the lodge. With it he opened and closed the lodge, with it he ruled. It is the symbol of his power. It is wonderful, if we think of it, how the humblest tool is put into the hand of the highest officer. So rough an instrument, the commonest in the quarry, hardly seems to typify a ruler. Yet, in the three principal offices of the lodge, it is the symbol of authority. The lodge is ruled not by the square, still less by the scepter, but by the sound of a common gavel. Only masonry could have thought of such a thing so beautiful. Nor is it wondered at, because no tool in the kit of the craft is used so often and in so many ways as the gavel. Yet, as someone has observed, in all its variety of uses, it remains the same. It is like a moral principle. It changes not. When the rough ashlar is first taken from the quarry, the first tool applied to it in the process of making it fit for its place is the gavel. Later, when the chisel must be used on the stone, the gavel is employed to carry into effect the design of the worker. The gavel is used in breaking large stones for the chipping off tiny fragments, and it is equally effective for both ends. While the square, the level, and the plumb has each one use and office, the gavel is used in many ways, either by itself or with other tools all the time. Cutting, chipping, driving, and setting it is always busy, always close to the hand of a mason. Alike for the suppression and for construction, its work never ends. It is the first tool of the craftsman, and the last he uses as a master of the lodge, if he is counted worthy of that honor by the merit of his labor and the trust of his brethren. The gavel is capable of doing great work, or of spoiling good material. It is at once the test and the triumph of a mason. So naturally, the gavel is an emblem of power. It is an emblem of the power for good or ill in the hands of each man, being the commonest of tools, and also of the power of the lodge in the hand of the master. If wielded roughly, it means ruin. If wielded weakly, it means failure. If wielded wisely, and in the spirit of brotherly love, it is a wand of magic and a scepter of goodwill. Man is tempered and tested by power as by nothing else. Few are the men able to use it and not abuse it. No man is a master mason or fit to be the master of a lodge until he has learned to use the gavel with dignity, self-control, and a gentle skill. Since the gavel is a symbol of the power both of masons and of masonry, it behooves us all to ask how it is being used. Is the gavel only an emblem and nothing more, like many another? Do we actually use it to cut away the vices and superfluities of life which unfit us for the use and service of the master builder? Or, to put it otherwise, do we take our masonry seriously as a way of learning noble ways of thinking and living? Or it is a thing of rote, to be neglected when anything gets in its way, just another order to belong to? In short, is masonry the power it should be in our lives and in the service of mankind? As the gavel sounds in the east, calling us to another year of Masonic labor, each of us ought to ask himself such questions as these, and answer them honestly in his own soul. What kind of lodge would my lodge be if all its members were like me? What value would masonry be to the world if every one of its sons made the same use of it as we do? Do we answer the signs and summons sent to us by the lodge, as we vowed to do at the altar? If not, what is the Masonic obligation worth, and what does it mean? Nothing? Such questions tell us where we are in Masonry and why we do so little with it. Surely, it's only fair to ourselves, as well as the craft, to ask ourselves such questions point blank. The Lodge opens on a new year, and we need to take stock of our Masonic life and duty. What we can lack more than anything else in America today as citizens and as Masons is a sense of personal responsibility for our laws and institutions, which enshrine the spirit and genius of our nation. If Masonry had a great place in the early days of the Republic, it was because Masons gave it a great place by serving the nation in its spirit. Truth wins if we are true to it and make it win. Just now, cynical writers in Europe are saying that American democracy must fail, that it cannot win. Of course, it has not failed, else there would be more kings and more slaves in the world. But America is still on trial, and it will win only in as so far as the village church and the lodge over the store become real centers of brotherly love and neighborly cooperation and goodwill. When this sort of friendly and practical friendship is abandoned by more than half of us, then our American democracy will fail and go to pieces, or else be only a shadow of itself. Here now some amazing facts which ought to make us ponder. Less than half of our people ever attempt, support, or are in any way associated with any kind of church. Fact to make a man stop and think, if he is aware of what happens to society when the influence of religion fails or grows dim. Not less amazing is the fact that hardly 15% of the craft ever attend lodge or pay any heed to the sound of the gavel in the east. It is appalling such sheer neglect by indifferences and carelessness of matter so vital to the well-being of the nation. The remedy, so far as Masonry is concerned, is not far to seek. It lies not far away, but nearby, asking each of us to take a new vow in his own soul to make his Masonry more real, more active, more in earnest, both in his lodge and in his life. Any other way, there is none, and it must begin with you and with me. It is not Masonry that is at fault, but Masons who forget and fail their duty. It is time for each of us to take up the common gavel, the first tool of a Mason, and divest our own souls of its apathy, ignorance, lack of zest, and zeal. What can we do to help the master of our lodge in the Masonic year now opening? At least we can go to lodge and be a worker in the quarry, and our presence will increase by so much the influence of Freemasonry, and it will teach us to be helpers in the encouragement of brotherly love and fellowship. No man knows how far a simple act may go. Gathering power as it goes, our loyalty may be the tower of strength to 50 men who otherwise may lose heart and fall away. Our faithfulness will be an inspiration to the master who is human like ourselves and pledged to bear any burdens in his heart. If each does his part, the sum of our labor will be very great, and the craft will increase in usefulness and power among men. At the end of the day, when the lodge of our life is closed and the sound of the gavel is heard no more, the one thing no man will ever regret is that he lived in the fellowship of our gentle craft and labored in its service. Our life here amid sun and frost has meaning to ourselves and worth to the master of all good work, only as we invest such power as we have of light and leading to make the hard old world a little kinder for those who come after us. The new age stands as yet half built against the sky, open to every threat of storms that clamor by. Scaffolding veils the walls, and dim dust floats and falls as moving to and fro their tasks the Masons ply. So there you have somewhat a poetic piece calling for us to treat Freemasonry better. I recently got in a great conversation, and I think you're going to look forward to a post from Worshipful Brother Scott Duball here in Illinois, and it'll be a joint post between he and I, where we have both had this conversation frequently about Masonry and its goals. And it seems that he and I both agree that there are some things that we're doing within the craft, personal things in our own lives, that might actually be a very far cry from what perhaps we should be doing. Recently, on a Grand Lodge post in Facebook, somebody had congratulated somebody on being elected master. And Scott had just a great point that it's the wrong choice of words. He said, "You've been selected to work and serve. You haven't won anything. It's too focused on personal achievement to ever accomplish anything as an organization." And I find that to be very relative. And we were talking about how we have to make do with what we have and how we are supposed to get things done and make masonry better? And how can we bring it back to the forefront of really what it should be? Scott and I were talking, and I said that a lot of people have called me militaristic and kind of a jerk, and it's because I've said that masonry needs to be held higher on our priority list. Nick Johnson has said many times that Freemasonry for many guys falls at the fourth or fifth spot in their life, sometimes three. You know, family, work, fraternity, and then the fraternity keeps on going down and down and down and down on the priority list. But for me, I've always felt that if you are primary officer of the lodge, meaning the junior, senior, or worshipful master, the wardens rather, that the lodge really should come as priority number one. Now, this is coming from somebody like myself who, in every job I've ever had, I've made it abundantly clear that lodge nights are my night and I will not be at work. My family knows that I will be at lodge, and if we have a family birthday party or something, it's not going to have a party on Monday night. But that's me, and that's how I perceive the responsibility of what we have. And not to say that it should be that way, but that's the way it is right now for me, right? Because the way I'm thinking of it is there's just no room in a fledgling institution for mediocrity. Maybe when our numbers are huge at 6 million Masons again, you can have room for this mediocrity and the fraternity doesn't have to be so high on the priority list. But I think we need to set an expectation that's super high, and we need to tell people that they need to be ready to make those sacrifices. And I think that's what is going to pull us through, and the successful lodges are going to be more successful because of that. But that's just my take. I'm very much involved in the fraternity, and if you're just a passive Freemason, that's cool too. But it is important that we are practicing Masonry in our day-to-day lives, even if we're not being administrators, and even if we're not paying the lodge bills. You know, if you're just a passive member who, you know, wears your Masonic ring every day to work and in your day-to-day life, and maybe talk to somebody occasionally about Freemasonry, well, you're doing a good part. But I would hope that we take it even farther and we work even harder. So the next piece that I've got is kind of a fun one. It's called The Ringling Brothers, The Six Lost Aprons, and it's by Brother Todd E. Creason from the Midnight Freemasons, and this was published quite a while ago. In fact, a very long time ago. But he wrote, and he started it, "I didn't write this. This was sent to me. I thought it was interesting, and I thought I'd share it. The following article was adapted from a piece which appeared in the Baraboo News Republic titled, Yesteryear Revisited. The text and accompanying photographs were prepared and submitted by Brother Steve Emerson, a Baraboo Lodge Past Master." So, here is that piece, and if you would like to see all of it, just download the Podcast Source app and find our show and download the extras, because in the PDF version, you'll have this with all the pictures. The night of January 21st, 1891 in Baraboo, Wisconsin was a special night for many of the men in Baraboo, and it has a direct connection to the special happening some 111 years later. The story includes six soon-to-be famous brothers and involves the ceremonial regalia they wore on that special evening. In those days, the Baraboo Masonic Lodge No. 34, free and accepted Masons still met, as did all other fraternal organizations, in rented upstairs halls in downtown. The lodge at this time, however, was strong enough that a building of their own was being considered. Members had arrived on horseback, by carriage, or on foot for the decisive evening, and the temple was full. Also in Baraboo of the day, the spectacular 7-year rise to national prominence of the Ringling Brothers Circus had brought not only respect, but also good fortune to many of the brothers. Their father, August, had been a struggling harness maker. As is well known, there were 7 Ringling boys, and young Henry had only recently become old enough for Masonic membership. It was most unusual for many as 6 of the Ringling brothers to be in town at the same time. It was especially unusual on this evening that the 6 brothers occupied many of the major chairs in the lodge. All 7 Ringling brothers, including John, were members of Baraboo Lodge before the year was out. Father August Ringling was to join his sons in the Masonic Order. On this particular night in 1891, with such famous brothers occupying the chairs, some very special aprons had been ordered as gifts. Made of the finest blue velvet instead of the plain white linen usually worn, each apron was embroidered with a silver thread and tassels. Central to the blue border was a white lambskin with the symbols of the office or chair being occupied embroidered thereupon. There is some speculation that the aprons were designed and produced by the Ringling Brothers Circus Wardrobe Department in Baraboo. On the back of each apron is the name of the Ringling Brother and the chair he occupied. Alf T., Worshipful Master, August, Senior Warden, Al, Junior Warden, Charles, Senior Steward, Henry, Junior Steward, and Otto, Tyler. Religiously speaking, the Ringlings were members of St. John's Lutheran Church, but nearly every church in Baraboo was represented among the other brothers present that night. The aprons emerge. What happened over the years to the blue velvet and white lambskin aprons with their silvery embroidery is of some interest. It is known that Mrs. Ida Henry Ringling, not to be confused with Ida Ringling North, gave the aprons nearly 50 years ago to one Richard Joe Bennett, boyhood chum of Ida's grandson, Henry Ringling III. Henry III died in an auto accident near Baraboo in 1961, and Bennett had become a friend and frequent visitor to Ida, Henry's grandmother. Among the gifts she gave to Joe were the aprons. It is presumed that they had been in the possession of Ida's husband, Henry Sr., and later with his wife Ida since 1891. Recently, an alert brother of Baraboo Lodge noted an apron listed for auction on eBay. Upon investigation, it was determined that not only was this an authentic original apron, but that all six were available. Moreover, thanks to some caring people during the last 111 years, the aprons were in mint condition and were still kept in their original boxes. In some cases, the original protective tissue paper was still present. Significant financial outlays were promptly made by five Baraboo Masonic brothers, Lee Hopp, Merlin Zitzner, Dave Depp, Skip Blake, and Rick Lewison. Others have made contributions for preservation of the aprons. This made it possible for the aprons to be returned to Baraboo, and they are now in possession of the lodge. Plans for the Ringling aprons are incomplete, but because of their historic importance, they may be offered for display at the Circus World Museum in Baraboo. A similar display may appear on occasion at the Al Ringling Theater, not even a dream for Al Ringling when his apron was presented to him in 1891. It would be 24 years before Al would build in Baraboo, what the Theater Historical Society of America calls the very first of the theater movie palaces, which became so popular throughout the country. It still operates today in its entire pre-revolutionary French architectural splendor, as perhaps the longest operating motion picture theater in the country. The stage is used some 60 times a year for live performances as well. Back to the meeting. So, as we take up the story of that special night in Baraboo Lodge, January 1891, the Ringling brothers occupied the chairs, the aprons they were presented, and the lodge prepared to build its own building. It is known that a committee was appointed and a fine building was built on the northwest corner of Oak and Second Avenue. It was this building, approved at the 1891 meeting, with the temple rooms upstairs and McGann's furniture on the ground floor, which would burn some 65 years later. This fire in 1957 destroyed nearly all of the lodge records, regalia, and artifacts. By good fortune, the ceremonial aprons had been removed by someone and were cared for properly for 111 years. Now they have been returned to their rightful home in Baraboo, relics of a special night. Special ties. Baraboo Lodge No. 34 observed its 150th year in 2002. The anniversary booklet published commemorates the event, reports that eight Ringlings were raised in Baraboo. Alfred T. Alf Ringling was raised on January 22, 1890. John was raised on March 1st. Albert was raised on March 29th, and Otto on April 9th. 11 months later, on February 4th, 1891, August G. Ringling was raised. Henry came next on March 18th, and August, Father Ringling himself, joined the craft on August 19th, 1891. The city of Baraboo has a heritage of two communities, the circus and the Masonic community. On the surface, they may appear completely different, the circus being an entertainment form for children of all ages and the Masonic Lodge being a fraternal organization created to help men better themselves and the community. A connection between the two organizations began when seven Ringling brothers and their father became Masons. Throughout the years, there have been many Masons with circus backgrounds, including members of the Gallmar family, circus owners, the Moeller family, circus wagon manufacturers, General Tom Thumb, Harry Houdini, Buffalo Bill Cody, and Baraboo's own Jimmy Williams, a.k.a. Happy the Clown. Tony Vinicky, Robert Hokum, the great-grandson of the Charter Junior Warden. The formation in the early 1870s of the Shrine helped create the bonds that grew between circus and masonry. The circus is one of the largest fundraising events for the Shrine Clubs. It's also a major source of income for circus performers. And that's it. So, I hope you enjoyed that. If you do enjoy this program, please consider purchasing a pin by going to www.wcypodcast.com. Click on Buy a Pin, and we ship anywhere in the world for $2. It's a pretty good deal. Also, if you want to support the show and get some cool stuff in while you do some shopping, I guess, then you can check out Support the Show by visiting our same website, wcypodcast.com, and pick yourself up some King Solomon's Reserve Beard Oil, or do some shopping at Onnit Labs, or you can do some shopping at freemasonryart.com or at bankersbest.com. They are the people who make the King Solomon's Reserve. And if you don't want to do shopping, you just want to donate to the program, please consider doing so. You can hit the donate via PayPal button right on our website. So if you can't find it, just click on Support the Show. And with that, I just want to say thanks so much. I've got to wrap it up. I'm actually on my way to a Masonic funeral tomorrow. It's Friday night, and I've got to drive 4 hours, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I got a long drive, and thanks so much again for listening. I hope you all enjoyed, and we'll talk to you all next week. So until then, stay on the level, and for Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.